Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is episode 115, and it's a two-parter, and it's super special. Before I get into that, I need to say a lot of love for all the love that was given for last week's podcast with Neil Woods. It's always exciting when I have someone who isn't a big celebrity name, but just a really interesting story and podcast. And Neil, if you missed it, was an undercover cop for 14 years in the war on drugs, the first in the UK to go undercover in drug-related crime and operations. And he's got a hell of a story and a hell of an outlook. So, yeah, glad you all enjoyed that. Thank you for spreading the word. I should mention that this week's podcast is brought to you by Speech Development Records. If you head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, not only is there a whole section of Distraction Pieces merch where you can get T-shirts and mugs and all sorts of cool stuff, but there's also a limited amount. There's a section just added. It might have sold out by the time this podcast goes out, but there's a signed section because a lot of people were sad they couldn't catch B. Dolan on his tour and get some signed stuff, and sad that they missed my book tour and couldn't get some signed stuff. So B. Dolan signed a load of vinyl before he went home. I went to the warehouse and signed a load of vinyl, a load of books and a load of DVDs. So check that all out at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Obviously, we've also got loads of other good stuff. We've got the We May Not Be For You and That's Fine slogan cap that is a hit of the summer. But yeah, there's loads of good stuff. There's music. We're stocked up on all vinyl. So we've got the Sage Francis vinyl, the B. Dolan vinyl, my vinyl, and the King Blues vinyl. So that's exciting. I feel on here I mention T-shirts and hats and mugs and aprons and all the other merch that we do a lot, but primarily we're a record label, so I'm very proud that we've got cool as fuck records there. Speaking of records, Sunday Best is the label that me and Dan Lesac originally signed to back in the day in 2006 or 2007, and they run a festival called Bestival. They also run Camp Bestival. And I played it constantly for years and years. And I also started about 5 years ago, at least, I started to run the spoken word stage there. It was called the Satin Lizard Lounge. Now, that was based on, I had a night years ago. This is a lot of story I'm giving you here. I had a night years ago at Pure Groove Records called the Satin Lizard Lounge. And it was a spoken word night with a bit of music at the end. And we made them into podcasts. And that was my first dipping of the toe into the world of podcasting. But the Satin Lizard Lounge turned into a thing that was at Camp Bestival and Bestival, and I've booked it for years. There's been 1 or 2 years where I've not been able to be there, but in general, I'll be hosting it. I'll book everyone. I'll be performing. I'll be introducing. And even on the years I haven't been able to be there myself, I've put a lot of effort into putting together a lineup and schedule that blows people away. And this year, we did it at Camp Bestival. It went down a treat, and we had our lineup all kind of planned and coming together for Bestival. And they've sadly had to cut it because of budget cuts. Now, don't get mad at Bestival. A lot of people, when they heard this from artists to attendees, were kind of mad about it. But the fact is, it's a tough time for festivals at the moment. There's 3 or 4 festivals every a weekend, really, just in the UK. And Bestival traditionally has been the big end of festival season festival. Well, whilst I still think it's the best festival of all, I honestly believe that. It's also at the end of the festival season. And if it's now and a time where you've probably been to 2 or 3 festivals already this year, then Bestival might be the one that gets cut from your budget. But again, the fact is, It's looking like it'll be a sellout as ever. It's looking like it'll be an amazing event. It's just it's been a bit of a struggle and a slower one. But yeah, as I said, my main point here is that Bestival is the best festival of all. So if you've never been, you should definitely go. But what I decided to do when we were cut, as I said, everyone on the stage was really down about it and bummed out. And I thought, hang on, at my stage at Bestival, I mean, we get up to about 500 people in this little amphitheatre. and it's awesome, and the atmosphere is amazing. It's got some of my happiest memories of recent years, some really emotional memories, and some of the happiest. But I've got a podcast that gets over 100,000 downloads a week, so I figured this year only, until we return to Best of All next year triumphantly, let's make this the Saturn Lizard Lounge everywhere in the world. Let's make it in your ears wherever you are. Today I would like to present to you the Saturn Lizard Lounge on the bus you're sitting on right now. Today I would like to present to you the Saturn Lizard Lounge in your living room, in your car, on your walk to work, on your jog, in your gym, wherever you choose to listen to this. So I spoke to six of the acts and said, look, what would be cool is if you came on and we did a little interview and had a chat, and then you did a poem each. And that was kind of key, because the point of the stage is that it's performance. But still, everyone's got an amazing story. Layout-wise, I wanted to have a chat and then end on a poem, because there's nothing more awkward. Like being a guy who's done spoken word for years on radio and at different places, there's nothing more awkward than when you perform a piece and then you've got the awkward thing of the host having to clap and be like, oh, that was fantastic. Great. That was a wonderful piece. It's really awkward and unpleasant for everyone. So I decided that we'll chat to each person and then we'll have a poem from them. So this is really a favourite episode, two favourite episodes. It's a two-parter. I'll tell you how we're going to divide this up. In part one, we're going to have Raymond Amphrobus, who's absolutely amazing. We're going to have Maria Ferguson, who's absolutely amazing. And we're going to kick it off right now with a guy I go on about a lot, Mr. Rob Alton. Now, Rob, as you will have heard, is the best thing I've ever seen at the Edinburgh Fringe. I didn't get around to mention it to him on this, but probably my favourite Best of All moment was Rob headlining, I think, 2 years ago, because he is an odd act and an odd... And we discuss it in the show. He is someone that his hour-long show, you have the time to get used to his unusual style, to fall in love with it. But in smaller sets, it's potentially hit or miss. Either you get it or you don't, and there's not time for it to develop. And the day had been going amazing. There'd been some amazing sets from some amazing poets. And then Rob was headlining. And from the first thing that he said, he had the whole amphitheatre just in love with him. And it was my favourite experience, because I knew he had nerves, I had nerves. But again, you've got to remember that although I'm booking these things, I'm just a fan, man. Like I'm one of Rob Alton's biggest fans in the world. He's also a mate, which is amazing and mind-blowing, but I'm one of his biggest fans. So to see everyone get him in the way that I get him from his first line, was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. I'll let this get on. Oh, I should tell you, in part two is one of the most requested and loved people on the spoken word scene. There's or three of, but I get a video sent to me a lot of people going, oh, you should check this poem out. And I often stay quiet on it because I don't want to be a hipster and be like, I already know about that person. How dare you presume that you can recommend someone to me? I'm very knowledgeable. But Holly McNeish is one of those people that I get recommended a lot. She's absolutely amazing. Her pieces, Mathematics and Embarrassed, have both gone hugely viral. Her piece, Megatron, should have gone equally viral. It's fantastic. But she's an amazing artist. So in part two, I'm going to have Holly McNeish. I'm going to have Jack Rook, who you're all going to fall in love with. That was one of the deepest chats I've had in a while. He's an amazing dude. I've got a lot of love for that kid. And then I'm going to round that one out with Cecilia Knapp, who I also have a lot of love for. I played her on the Beatdown in the past. I'm a big fan of Cecilia Knapp. So, that's how it's going to run. I'll be back at the end to tell you about what's going on. Basically, this part is going up at midnight as ever, and part two will be up at midday. But this is the Saturn Lizard Lounge special of the Distraction Pieces podcast, part one.
This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces.
Right, I am joined now by Rob Alton. How are you, sir? You waited until I asked you to take a swig of water, so that
yeah. Was... I'm all right, thanks. I'm all right. I'm enjoying this pint glasses. These ones are normally half the size, aren't they?
Yeah, I hate it when I go anywhere and the water supplied is the smallest glass imaginable.
Yeah,
it's just out of the tap, mate. I'm after bottled water. I just want tap water. Just give me a decent sized glass. So I purposely made sure I got you a pint of water. Upon request.
I appreciate it.
Let's kind of go to where I first heard of you. I kind of first heard of you through Bang Said the Gun, but I've kind of first heard of Bang Said the Gun through you.
Okay.
Because I think it was Polar Bear was saying, there's this guy, Rob Alton, he's amazing. He's at this night at Bang Said the Gun. And then I heard more of Bang Said the Gun, which, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. It's a spoken word night, and the thing that blew me away about it was it isn't like any other spoken word night I've ever been to.
Yeah.
So what was kind of, you're one of the creators or regulars or something of the camera. What was the idea behind it? How did it all come about?
Well, I got on board about 2008, I think.
Yeah.
And Martin Galton and Dan Cockrill had been running it for about 15 years. Yeah, a long time, yeah, on and off. Doing it in, bars in Soho and things like that. Yeah. And then we started doing it at the Roebuck pub in Borough monthly. Yeah. And then we started doing it weekly. And then when we started doing it weekly, it started to get a bit more momentum.
Yeah.
But the thing with that night is, just wanted it to be, a fun party atmosphere.
That's exactly what I was going to say. There's not, and I've gone to loads of spoken word nights. I thoroughly enjoy them, but not many feel like a party.
Yeah.
They all feel like spoken word nights. Whereas the first time I went to that, I was like, as soon as you're in the room, there's a bit of a buzz. And then as soon as the music's playing and the shakers are out and all this kind of thing, it's like, oh wow, this is a night out.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that was it with, I think, the music. So, okay, right, we'll put some Little Richard on and some of the Blues Brothers soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
Put it on as loud as we can.
Yeah.
And I mean, you got to be pretty cold-hearted to not tap your foot.
Exactly.
And then, right, we'll give people milk cartons full of chickpeas to shake. And the majority of people stuff like shaking stuff to music, do they?
You enjoy that, didn't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I know I do. I'm like, oh yeah, come on, baby. But then we did that, and then, now we've been doing it a fair bit. We just, I got back from Edinburgh, did a show there. I love it.
Yeah.
I really love it.
It's just a really good night, and the variation of people I've seen, it seems to be one that poets are excited to do as well.
Yeah.
Like everyone I know seems to be like really up for it if it's Bang Said the Gun. So
I think it's
got to be a good sign.
You know, that thing of just trying to get up for something and be like, okay, what can we try to create that we believe in and put on a show for people and just try and make something that doesn't exist and make it exist. And just that's the same with everything I've been trying to do, is just trying to make something exist that doesn't exist.
That doesn't exist, yeah. So what was your kind of, because what I love, I saw you at Bang Said the Gun and thoroughly enjoyed you, and then I came to see the Sky Show, and as I've raved about numerous times, it was my favourite thing of the Fringe. I think it was 2013, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I loved it, but I still don't know what your shows are.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's comedy, if it's spoken words, if it's... Yeah. So what kind of... normally I'd ask now, what made you get into comedy or what made you get into spoken word or whatever? But I guess it's just what made you get into performing and creating these odd little shows.
I think just walking around and having ideas.
Yeah.
Little things kind of popping into your head and me liking them enough for me to want to write them down. and then, first of all, writing them down so they don't disappear, so I can read them again.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
And then I guess I thought, well, I'll get on stage and see if anyone else likes them.
Yeah.
Sometimes people like them, and sometimes it's only me that likes them.
Yeah.
And that's all right.
It's actually fine.
But sometimes when it's just me that likes them, and it's a room of 50 people, it's like, all right, maybe that one is just for me, you know.
It's an interesting one, because your type of show and your show, a key part of The Fringe and a key part of a lot of performance scenes is doing either open mics or variety shows or whatever else.
Yeah.
With your shows, again, I remember that first year at The Fringe, seeing you seeing Brett Goldstein, seeing Tom Rosenthal, and seeing these people who it's a complete show, and each of them, I couldn't imagine how you would take a part of that and put that in a five minute slot, for example, or a 10 minute slot. So how do you find that? And does that give you a get out clause if it doesn't go well in your mind? Because it's like, well, this is a small section of a far bigger thing.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily always going to work in this room, in this different audience.
I think it's, sometimes with the hour shows I've done when I've tried to do them in smaller sets is difficult.
Yeah.
Just because I think with the hour shows, it takes a while for people to make their mind up.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes 50 minutes for people to be like, oh, well, all right, yeah, I like this.
Yeah.
Or, no, right, he's lost me. Come on, we're going.
Yeah.
And so with the shorter sets I do, like, say, when I've done Best of All, just try to pick the stuff that I have, that I like, and that I think people can kind of take as, like, a snack-sized bit of stuff, I don't know. But with the hour shows, I mean, the first one I did was called The Yellow Show.
Yeah.
And before that, I did a thing in 2009, I was part of a thing called the Big Comedy Breakfast.
Yeah.
And it started at 11:30 in the morning, and we did 15 minutes each. It was me and then three comedians, and we'd just do I don't even know if they're poems or not. It's just writing.
Yeah,
I just write stuff down, read it out on stage.
Yes.
Whatever that is. And make books with it in and drawings. And I'll let other people, if they want to call it something, that's fair enough.
That's fine.
But I mean, I did 2009. And then I was like, oh, people are doing shows for an hour. I wonder if I could do a show for an hour.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, why don't, it might be good if I give myself a theme to write to.
Yeah.
And then at least because I love working to a brief.
Yeah.
And like putting the word in the middle of the spider diagram and being like, what can we do with this? How can we do this? How can we do that? And it gives me a year to think about something, or 8 months, or just to think about one thing.
And to focus on one thing.
So like there's a case here that's the colour yellow. So I'm walking around looking at yellow lines, post-it notes, and just being like, wow, okay. And not sound like an idiot, but I love the fact that people know what the colour yellow is, and I know what it is, you know?
Yeah.
I find it exciting, and if that's sad that I find that exciting, then I'm sorry, but I feel like that's something that we've got in common.
Yeah.
We know what the colour yellow is, right? So with that first show, I was like, okay, come on, let's, how can I make, okay, right, I'll have a yellow backdrop.
Yep.
So I need to go to Walthamstow Market, get a big bit of yellow cloth, write yellow on it in acrylic. Okay, there's my backdrop. Now what can I do? Right, I'll get a yellow coat, and I'll read from the yellow pages, and I'll go to Argos, get the Argos catalogue, cut all the things out that are yellow, make a page of it, stick it in the Argos catalogue, is the yellow stuff, whatever. And then I'd the idea to make these yellow vision glasses that was just made out of cardboard, got some yellow acetate, and then gave them out to the audience. So everyone was watching the show through yellow tinted glasses.
I love it.
And in the press release, it was the first time I'd ever done a press. I was like, what am I going to do here? So I learned that people send things out to journalists to try to get them to come to the show.
Yeah.
And I just got back from, I've been on holiday somewhere, and I'd got these this pad of yellow submarine. I love the Beatles, and it was a pad of the yellow submarine thing. So I was like, right, I'll handwrite some letters, put it on yellow submarine paper, send them some yellow vision glasses. And some journalists actually came to the show because of that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, so maybe the theme thing can work sometimes. But, I mean, no one came to the yellow show in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
For the first... Well, no, people did come, but only because I fly for 3.5 hours a day.
Yeah.
Sitting in a yellow paddling pool on the Royal Mile with a, and I had one of those long noodle things, you know, that you have for swimming.
Yeah, yeah.
That you get in the pound shops. Yeah. Long bits of foam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I cut a slice in the end with a scalpel, stuck my yellow show flyer, and then fished it out. People took the flyers. And if they liked my flyering technique, then they'd come to the show.
And, that's a solid theory.
But, mate, I mean, you know, it was mixed responses, but yeah. I knew that you've got to do what you like, right?
Yeah.
And you've got to... I would go along the Royal Mile and think, if I saw myself, would I want to go and see that show?
Yeah.
And if the answer isn't yes, then I've got to change it. And it's the same with performing, thinking like, if I saw someone read something, read this out, would I engage with it?
Yeah.
Would I want to be that person?
That's a great analysis to put yourself under. It reminds me of one of the first times I was talking to Polar Bear, and not one of the first times actually. I would gig together a bit, and every now and then, it'd leave a gig. It'd be like, I'm not feeling this.
Yeah.
I don't like this crowd. Yeah. And he explained to me one day, he's like, I try and think every time, if I'm halfway through my set and my mates walked in,
yeah,
how would I feel?
Yeah.
Or would I be excited that they're here, or would I be embarrassed that they're seeing me doing this?
Yeah.
And if it's embarrassed, I do what I can to not do it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's a similar thing there of having that analysis of going, am I doing this because I can get booked or people will tell me it's good, which could be flash in the pan, they care for a minute and don't care next, or am I doing this because it's something I like and I believe in?
So
it's good to have that self-analysis. It's dangerous as well because you can overanalyze and start to panic. But what... the first show of yours I saw was the Sky Show. Mm. And what has excited me ever since then is that it's finding these, it's realizing that the bulk of the performance is, or the bulk of the show is you. What people are invested in and what I come to see now as a fan is Rob Alton.
Yeah.
So the topic, not that it's irrelevant, but it's finding that topic and then exploring it.
Yeah.
And DJ Yoda on one of the first podcasts I did has said the same. He said he struggles a lot more just making a DJ Yoda album than if someone says, can you do a Halloween album?
Yeah.
Or can you do a swing-based thing? Because it's like, oh, I've got a topic. I've got a subject now. I can now go off and delve into that.
Mm.
So like, how do you choose your subjects of the sky, of water, of sleep?
Yellow came about because I needed a new coat and I got a yellow coat from Lillywhite.
As good a reason as any.
And it was really weird. I started wearing this yellow Mac.
Yeah.
And my mood changed. And
amazing.
I kind of became kind of, every time I put it on, I felt ever a tiny, tiny, tiny bit more happy.
Yeah.
And I was at a Secret Garden Party festival, right?
Yeah.
And it was like 10 o'clock in the morning and someone was doing a happiness workshop.
Yeah.
And I was in my yellow coat and this guy was like, oh, one way to be more happy is to wear more brightly coloured clothing. And I had a horrific hangover, like I had my, you know, hand covering my eyes and was in this yellow coat. And he was like... I think he actually said, like, oh, come on, this guy's disproving my theory, but
he's ruining it.
But that was, and then I thought, right, okay, well, if I can do a brightly coloured show, then maybe that'll be a thing. And then the sky, I was just like, wow, man, flipping love the sky.
It's great, isn't it?
Again,
it's what came across from what just won me over instantly. That I was like, I wonder what the sky show is going to be. And then within 10 minutes, it's like, oh, right, dude just really loves the sky. And yeah, that's what the show is. And that's fucking beautiful, man.
But, I mean, it's not like, it's not me being like, hey, guys, I love the sky. You know?
No, it's
like,
not.
I want to try to convey how I feel about a blooming massive thing.
Yeah.
It's so big.
Yeah.
And the fact that if someone said, hey, I've got a scaffolding pole, and it goes on for infinity, here you go, start threading it out. And if you did that and it went on, it would just go on forever and ever 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 and ever. I
think
about that and then see some of the stuff that I see on the news. I'm like, how did this get so out of hand? I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's kind of, it makes me feel small. I like things that make me feel small and insignificant, because then it frees me up to kind of do what I want.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Okay. Well, screw this. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
You know, if we live in like an infinite space and I am, you know, not much bigger than an ant or whatever, I don't know.
Comparatively.
I feel it very, very freeing.
Yeah.
And that's what, I just want to feel free a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So with water, I did the show called The Water Show, and I'm always blown away by like the fact that we have so much in common with animals, and you know, seeing a dog, really love drinking from a bowl of water. It's like, hey, I know how that feels, mate. No. And having this stuff, just having stuff in common.
Yeah.
And like having that, looking at a dog in the eye and being like, hey, you got eyes, you know, and just being like, and just trying to feel something about that and just going, wow, not being like, hey, yeah, whatever, screw this, I'm going to be miserable, come on, I'm going to go to work. How about just looking at something and being, just for me, like, it's almost me having a battle with myself to try to stay inspired and excited by all the stuff.
By everything,
And just that is the good side of things. And then the bad side is seeing people getting killed by other people, and all, like, the bright side is I'm like, whoa, baby, I've been born onto this magnificent, incredible place.
Yeah.
And then the dark side of it is like, hey, come on, don't spoil it.
Yeah.
You know? This isn't what it's meant to be like. And then
something that's got me with each of your shows, and I said I've only seen the Sky Show and now the Sleep Show, but I saw the Sky Show a few times. And something that's got me is exactly that, the kind of the battle that you're almost having internally, or the conflict you're having between the good and the bad. Because every time I've seen you, I've laughed uncontrollably, but it also, without fail, I've shed tears at your shows. And that's, I don't cry at all these shows, and it's never shed tears in a, it's always in a, I don't know, a cathartic manner. But every time you've managed to get me, even when I'm going in and the Sleep Show was a new one to me, I was like, right, I'm ready for this one. I'm just going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And it got me again. So is there a conscious thing there of trying to represent both sides of that conflict in some way, to try and focus on the positive and the happiness, but also, even if it's just acknowledge that it's not all, isn't it a shame that when we leave this room, we don't only have to think about the colour yellow
or how great
the sky is. Yeah. In this moment, oh, we can have this, but man, at some point it ends after an hour and we have to have to go.
I just try to, with the shows, always try to tap into what I've been feeling walking around, and sometimes the despair of, you know, sitting at your kitchen table and just like, what is going on?
Yeah.
You know? I remember with the Paris attacks, like, I was just head on my kitchen table, just being like, whoa, man, this is, it's, I mean, just trying to get your head around that.
Yeah.
And just trying, I mean, someone who was, as a onlooker, just like, just being like, wow, trying to figure out how I feel about some, that happening.
Yeah.
And, just the contrast in the beauty and the beastliness of it all is just kind of like, it's overwhelming. And I think it's not like I get on the tube and I'm overwhelmed. Yeah. It's like, but sometimes I have surges of being like, whoa, baby. Yeah. And I think everyone does, don't they? It's not it's not like I'm a flipping freak
I've discussed this before and been looked at like a maniac, but I studied photography for a while and I love photography, but part of the basis was photography still blows my mind that we're here in the real world. And it's really easy to ignore. And now it's even on our phones, but we somehow grab a bit of that.
Yeah.
And then it's frozen and you've got that forever. That's there. That's something that was real and existed and you could touch it. Yeah. And now it's just this, you've grabbed a representation of it on your phone or whatever else. And that's, that kind of shit blows my mind.
Yeah.
Regularly. And I guess it's finding those things that can
just switch you on,
inspire
it?
You in that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing with, again, just to, the Paris attacks throw a good parallel to me to the experiences I have at your shows, which sounds like a huge amount of pressure to put on you there, but the fact that there was this darkness and this thing happened, and then that same night was one of the most beautiful moments for me in human history, of seeing all those people all together in the square, all saying not afraid and all this kind of thing. And that to me was just like, as you said, it's seeing that you've just seen how horrendous humans can be, and then all of a sudden you've seen the absolute pinnacle of how amazing humans can be, and all these people just in this square just saying, no, we're not angry, we're not after revenge, we're here to say that we're not afraid, we're still humans and we're still beautiful, and yeah, amazing stuff. But yeah,
well, I think I've been trying to get into the moment more and more.
Yeah.
And just trying, with gigs and just in life in general, and just being like, just trying to speak to people and with my friends and things, and just be like, okay, this is this now, this, we're here, this is now. And all the, and then seeing some of the stuff that's going on in the world, you're like, how is that? All that stuff that has led you to do that. I don't know. I better not go into too much, but I don't know, man. It's overwhelming. But with the shows, yeah, this show was about sleep.
And again, the thing that amazed me was turning up to the first one this year, and it's at the Free Fringe, and I've been to a few different things, but turning up for your first one and seeing the queue building and people having to be turned away.
Yeah.
How must that feel? I said, like, having started doing the Yellow Show a few years back, and as you said, not many people there, to now it's opening night and they're having to turn people away.
Yeah. Well, it felt great. I think it felt great. I mean, I looked in the mirror just before I went on, when I went to get my book and things like that, and there was a mirror in where the book was, and I was just white as a sheet just before I went on. Yeah. And, it was a strange show, that, because I had been doing previews of the show and I just put so much work into it in the last couple of weeks just before.
Yeah.
And I changed the show quite a lot. And I know the show you came to after it, I was just kind of in bits, really, of just knowing that I've got to do this for a month.
Yeah.
And luckily, I really like the stuff that I'd written.
Yeah.
But to see the people want to come and see the show.
Yeah.
Is absolutely staggering. I mean, there was a guy there on the last day, and I was like, how many times you been, man? And he said, I've this is the fourth time. I've been four times to see the Sleep Show. And that, I mean,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that is, and I like that. I think that reviewers and people like that should have to go and see shows four times before they can review it, because it's different every time.
Yeah,
just depends who's in there. And I come away from Edinburgh this time feeling quite encouraged.
Yeah,
and that's so important, to feel encouraged by, you know, thinking, okay, some people seem to be getting on board.
Yeah,
and you know, if you're having a conversation and the person you're having a conversation with is not encouraging you to say another sentence, you'd be like, well, I'm not going to, screw this.
I'm done with this. Yeah.
And it's the same with an audience. Like, if you're there and they're not encouraging you and they're like, oh, no, I'm not, don't encourage him, don't encourage him. I don't like this, don't encourage him.
Yeah.
Whereas if they're like, either laughing or just making noises or being present in the room, and as an audience member, if I go to a show and I'm enjoying it, I want to try to encourage the person to, for the magic to happen, because it's when the ball starts rolling and the encouragement's there from the audience. You know, like, if you're there and someone says, don't encourage him, because you know it might kick off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, no, don't encourage him, because it's there. And it's like, if you encourage, it's just all about encouraging. If an audience encourages a performer to go further than they've ever gone before with the show, like, come on, you can do this.
Yeah.
Like, that's where like the sparkle and like the explosions sometimes happen. And there's been a few gigs where I've come away from it and I'm like, that was one of my favorite gigs ever, because the audience really got into it and I really got into it. We both got into it at the same time.
Yeah.
And you must, like, leaving those gigs where you know that you've got to the same place at the same time with an audience.
Yeah.
And you've all gone on the journey together and you've come away from it and you're like, yes.
Yeah.
And there's no way, like, if there's a couple of people that didn't enjoy it, you're like, fair enough. But
we all went there and went on that same journey together.
And it's just like a party, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and you can try and recreate the party. You have the same people there, you have the same music on, you have the same alcoholic drinks, but sometimes it's going to be magic and sometimes it's just going to fall a bit flat and you're like, oh, well. And it's often, you know, when you do something for the first time, so if you had like a group of people together and you have a party, you're like, oh, that was a great party, wasn't it? Should we do it again next week?
Yeah.
And it's never as good.
It's not going to be the same. No. Yeah. Completely. So we'll wrap things up and I'm going to get you to perform a piece to end, but where can people keep up to date with you? And what's going on with the Sleep Show? Are you doing a run in London?
Yeah, I'm doing a run of the Sleep Show at Soho Theatre from the 21st to the 24th of September.
Excellent.
And all the dates are on my website, roborton.co.uk. We've got Bangs Head the
Gun. And that's Orton spelled A-U-T-O-N.
A-U-T-O-N, yeah. We've got Bangs Head the Gun coming up at Leicester Square Theatre.
Amazing. That would be great.
Yeah. If we can, I mean, that's a big room, isn't it?
It's a great room as well, though. It'd be great in there.
We're going to have to make some more shakers, hopefully.
Yeah.
But, I've got a website, and one of my favourite things to do is write a newsletter. It's not really news. I just start writing on my computer and don't stop for as long as I can, and send it to the people who subscribe to it.
Brilliant.
Sometimes it's quite long, but just a postcard really from where I'm at. And
I love it.
I hope this chat's been all right.
It's been great. Well, let's end on, are you going to end, you said you're going to end on the piece that you end the Sleep Show with, so
yeah. Okay, so some of the most challenging sleeps I ever had came as a child on Christmas Eve, because I knew if I got to sleep, my reward would come in the shape of Father Christmas having been. And this year I woke up to find that I'd received a letter from Father Christmas. It read, "Dear Rob, I hope you've enjoyed the presents I've given you over the years. I have certainly got great pleasure from reading your lists. This year, I thought I could give you my Christmas list. I realise you are busy and may not be able to meet all my requirements, but I would really appreciate it if you could find the time to give it a go. I know you've got no way of checking, but I think I've been a good man this year. I've been a loving husband and have kept the reindeer in good health. Rudolph recently became a father. His son was not born with a red nose, though, so there is controversy surrounding the question of who the father is. Please find my Christmas list enclosed. I thought, what? How dare Father Christmas send me his Christmas list? I don't know who is Father Christmas to Father Christmas, but it is definitely not me. I am Father Christmas to nobody. And then I thought, hold on a minute. If Father Christmas has sent me his Christmas list, does that mean Father Christmas believes in me? I took the letter and began to read it. Rob, there's one gift I would like from you this year. As a gift to me, I would like you to attempt to become as comfortable within yourself when you are awake as you are when you're asleep. Why have you become quieter in social situations? Please don't disappear into yourself completely. It's okay to shut yourself off at night time, but not when you're awake. Stop overthinking every single thought you have. Anxiety is not the capital of you. Take note of those words you wrote down that the cricket commentator said. Try your best, but don't take yourself too seriously. My elves have been watching you talk to yourself in your kitchen when you're on your own. They tell me what you say and I don't believe what you think of yourself is true. They told me that recently you said you prefer being asleep to being awake. That you feel like you fit in when you're asleep. I know you don't mean that. Sleep is the cement that sticks your days together. Over time, your days build up. From them, create something you can be proud of. Yourself. When you fall asleep and do something in your dreams, it doesn't stay. You can't build on any relationships in your sleep. There is no progress. You've got a recurring life that's in your hands when you wake up. Make the most of it. A recurring dad you can phone up. It's solid. Kate planted some sweet peas in the garden, didn't she? Never in your wildest dreams will that happen. You're awake. Act like you are out of bed. Do something to make yourself tired while you still can. Grip your waking hours by the scruff of the minutes. Lay down knowing you have earned your horizontal time. Try to go to sleep looking forward to the absolute mission of tomorrow. It's challenging being awake, but worms do it. It can't be that hard. When did sleep become your happy place? You used to drive. Now it's like you're falling asleep at the wheel of your own life. Work to be brave. Make your sleep in life the shadow of your waking life so the dream version of you looks on with envy, watching you fight in the ring of reality you are trying to create for yourself. Go to bed knowing anything you achieve in your dreams isn't going to come close. You have never had your hair cut in your dreams, Rob, or had a shower or shaved or bought clothes. That guy is in a right state. All his teeth have fallen out. Not that he has ever looked in the mirror. He has never washed up or cleaned the bathroom. He has never been to sleep. He must be absolutely knackered. He could fly, but he doesn't. What does that mean? Maybe you're not bothered about flying. Public transport is there. May as well use it. The best thing he has ever done is when he had the chocolate all the way through Kit Kat experience, but with an apple. He bit into it to find it was skin all the way through and continued to try to bite into it until it disappeared. Sleep is the cocoon. I want you to wake up in the morning and break out of that sleep shell. Head first, fly at it, fueled by your favourite cocktail, self-doubt and determination. The smell of ripening tomatoes, the sight of returning green cycle helmet through the window. Walk, pace, run, get into them, get broken and heal. I want the gulf between the awake and the asleep versions of you to widen, attempting to instigate some sort of awakening within yourself. Every time your eyes open from a night's sleep is too much to ask. I've tried it, but this year, Rob, I really want you to prove you're awake. I want you to do this for me as you've seemed so disconnected of late. Being awake is other people. If what some of them are doing makes you prefer the sleep side, they have won. Don't detach yourself from what you love. Plug yourself into the mains of what you have been born into and switch yourself on while you still have the chance. This isn't a present for me, Rob. It is a present for you. All the best, your friend and constant observer, Father Christmas.
joined now by Maria Ferguson. How are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I'm good. I'm delighted to have you on. You're just in Edinburgh Fringe recovery. How was it for you?
Yeah, it was pretty full on.
Yeah.
It was pretty heavy, but amazing experience.
It's intense, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's so intense.
Yeah.
Especially like because it's a one woman show.
Yeah.
And I was up there on my own.
I didn't really have a team or anything. It's your first time doing it, right? It's not your first time at Edinburgh because you've been up there in collectives and stuff like that before. But the show is it
Fat Girls Don't Dance.
Don't Dance.
Yeah.
And it's your first time doing that up there. I mean, I need to get straight off the bat with some congratulations because I'm seeing tons of sold outs and being on that sold out board regularly. So,
oh, thanks, mate.
So
yeah.
How was that for you?
It was great. I mean, I didn't expect that at all.
Yeah.
Audience was probably the thing I was most worried about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I heard these stories about how in Edinburgh the average audience is, what, like six
yeah.
people?
Yeah.
And I had a 60-seat venue at the Underbelly.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody knows who I am. I was just thinking, you know, God, how am I going to fill these seats? But, yeah, word of mouth in Edinburgh
it's
is
really
an
weird,
incredible
isn't it, as well, because word of mouth, absolutely key. A review's absolutely key. But also, as stupid as it is, the posters and the name of your show and stuff like that, I think are really key and help as well.
Yes, definitely.
And it's, I don't know, it's such a weird concoction of pressures in a way, because
yeah.
it's like, it's not just, is your show good?
Yeah.
Like, that's not the beginning and end of it. Your show could be good, and that only gets picked up halfway through the run. You can do the first half with no one there, and
yeah.
do you know what I mean? So it's an odd one, but,
oh, by
but
end,
how have you survived? How have you coped?
I mean, by the end, I was sick of the sight of my own face. Like, I just saw my face with a cake in front of it all
yeah.
around Edinburgh.
Yeah. But it was a good poster, and
it was great.
a good
and
name of the show as well. It kind of instantly
yeah.
evokes interest. Instantly, I was like, right, you kind of intriguing in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
instantly accessible.
I think it's a very provocative title.
Yeah. yeah.
Fat Girls Don't Dance. People were, you know, straight away like, oh, what's that about?
Yeah,
what's going on there?
Yeah.
Or they're like, oh, you're not fat. Like,
you're
not allowed to do it. You're not fat, which was an interesting conversation to have with people when I was
yeah.
flyering and stuff like that.
Dad, you find yourself for the first time in your life arguing about your weight in the opposite direction.
I started being sort of like, yes, it is an ironic title. Congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
Well done you for noticing. But yeah, I think it's good because it does spark conversation within people. And that's something I really wanted out of the show
yeah.
was to get people talking about things like this, about relationships with food, about eating disorders.
I was going to say, so what is the show and what's it about and what kind of inspired you to pick this topic?
So the show is basically an exploration of my relationship with food
yeah.
in parallel with me growing up training as a dancer, which I did for 15 years.
Yeah.
But it's also just sort of looking at the way people think about food, think about size, think that you need to look a certain way to do a certain thing.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like a battle back from that. But I, you know, tap dance in it, give out
yeah.
free cake.
Amazing.
You know, it's quite funny. People were laughing, which is good because
yeah.
I did
yeah,
write it to
handy.
Be funny.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people think they can't laugh because of the subject.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to tackle stuff like that with humour. So to make it more accessible.
Again, Edinburgh's a tough one, particularly, I mean, you come from a spoken word background. The whole a one-woman show thing or one-person show, however you wish to word it,
yeah.
if you wish to genderify it, it's an interesting one because a lot of people are at Edinburgh just for stand-up. And I think
yeah.
spoken word at times is under, feels extra pressure there of do we need to be funny as well and
mm.
and one-person shows as well, which have kind of quite beautifully started to take the reins at Edinburgh
totally.
A little bit. Even the comedy shows, they are it does tend to be rather than a gig, it's more of a here's a one person show, here's a story being told or a theme being explored.
Yeah.
So did you feel that pressure to add humour, or was that a natural part of your telling of this story and tackling of the subject?
That was a natural part of it, I think. Like, I wouldn't have wanted to do something too heavy because you have to bear in mind your audience as well. You have to be safe and your audience has to be safe watching
yeah,
it.
Of course.
And I think humour really does, you know, help you with that. But, you know, there are very dark parts of the show as well, and I
yeah.
think it's important to have that balance, which I hope I did justice.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd wanted to do a solo spoken word show for such a long time, and I didn't want to do it until I had an idea that I thought was important, but also a way of doing it that I thought was individual, because the show's very physical. There's like two like sort of languages going on at the same time, both verbal and physical.
Amazing.
And it took a long time to develop that. I worked on it for about a year and a half to get that right. And so I think that's important, that sort of, not necessarily being cross arts, but having something that's original and individual to you, something only you can do.
I was going to say, that's right to you. When I was chatting with a Raymond Anthropus, we were saying how there became a point where it was kind of a trend that you get to a certain level in spoken word and then you have to work on your one-person show.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's fine, as you said, if you've got something to do a one-person show on. It shouldn't just be, oh, this is what I have to do next. So that's what's nice to hear and exciting to hear, that you took a long time going, right, what is my one-person show? Yeah. How is my one-person show? Where did you develop it, and what's the process in developing a show like this?
I developed it with Roundhouse and Battersea Arts Centre. I've been a resident artist for both venues, and they're amazing venues. I scratched it at the Roundhouse in May last year for the Last Word Festival.
Yes.
That was the first time I scratched it, and I sort of took feedback from that, worked on it a bit more, did it at Camp Festival and at BAC, another scratch there. Also did some performances in schools for teenage girls.
Amazing.
So did a condensed version of that, bringing up the subject of body image and eating disorders or disordered eating. Did workshops with those as well, with the girls writing about body image. Some poetry, took a Warsan Shire poem, who I adore, and sort of got them to write their own version. And I think all of that was very important for me to do while I was making the show. It also took me back to when I was that age, because a lot of the stuff in the show is around that sort of part of my life.
Right, yeah, it's perfect.
So then developed it more with the help of BAC mainly, and did a four-night run of it there in February, which sold out, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
I was so worried. And it sold out, and it did pretty well. So then I worked on it a little bit more before I went to Edinburgh, previewed it at Rich Mix in June, and then have just done 24 shows, 24 dates.
I love the practicality of that, of working it through in a thought-out, augmented manage. I mean, rather than just going, oh, here's my show, here's what it is. I love the idea of going in and doing workshops and talking to people and trying it and changing and allowing a project to develop over time. Mm. Do you think a lot of that has come from working over the years with the Roundhouse and at the Roundhouse? I first became aware of you and a load of different people all coming. When I had you on as the Roundhouse Collective
a
years back. So how was that, being part of something like this? So the Roundhouse Collective is essentially a group where you were all kind of taught, and you had people like Polar Bear, or the Roundhouse has people like Polar Bear teaching. They've had numerous different people in over the years.
Yeah, old Uncle P.
Yeah.
So we had Polar as a mentor for a year. I mean, I didn't even really know what spoken word was.
Yeah.
I'd been to drama school for 3 years, and I knew Polar, I knew yourself, and I knew Kate Tempest, and that's probably about it, because I'd seen like videos that people had shown me.
Yeah.
But I went for an audition, and I'd been...
I mean, that's all us three now as well.
Yeah,
me,
that's
Polar, and Kate. We don't really socialise with anyone else.
The big three, the holy trinity. But yeah, I'd been writing these things when I was at drama school, and they happened to rhyme, but I didn't really know what they were.
Yeah.
And I went to an audition, and you could do your own work. So I performed one of these things that I'd written, and they were like, oh, you know, you should go to the Roundhouse. They've got this spoken word program.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, right, what's that then?
Yeah.
And they told me about the slam they have every year. They have a summer poetry slam. Yeah. So I went in for that, and I ended up getting to the final, and Polar Bear was like, do you want to come and do this thing for a year, writing with me every Sunday? And
oh,
I was
wow.
like, well, yeah, obviously.
I've never really known that much how it works. So it's basically you'll go every Sunday and there'll be a group of you and he'll be there as a mentor, or whoever is the mentor at that time, and kind of take you through workshops and the process of developing your work, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it was like two and a half hours on a Sunday afternoon, which was a lovely way to spend a Sunday.
Yeah.
And obviously I still I'm very close and work very closely with the people in that collective, with Jack and Cecilia and Jess. Yeah. And it was really valuable to really hone in on your work and find your way of writing and your own voice.
Yeah.
And I mean, writing for your specific voice, I find fascinating anyway.
Yeah.
And I think it's only natural that you start to emulate other people or take on other people's ways of writing or ways of speaking. But it takes a while for you to sort of develop your own way. And when you find it, you're like, right, that's me. That's it.
I completely agree. And that's what's hugely exciting at the moment is because that first time at Bestival, I think it was literally three or it was a good a few years back, wasn't it? The first time I had you guys as the Roundhouse Collective were on that stage.
That must have been about three, four years ago.
I was going to say, I think four, because it was before we were in the amphitheatre was the first time. It was when we were actually in the woods still, so it was this small stage.
Yeah.
Because you guys were on at the end of it, essentially. And what's really exciting now is the fact that at that point, I could see Polar Bear's influence on everyone. And not in a bad way, but you could see like
exactly what you mean.
You could tell you're all good, and you could tell who had made you all good or who had helped coax it out of you cunning. But what's exciting now is seeing, and Jess is another great example from what I've seen of her current stuff. It's amazing. And seeing all of you now seem completely individual, completely unique, but it's from having that rooting in a really good kind of starting point,
he was an amazing mentor. And I think I have to admit, I think in the beginning I was writing pieces that I knew Polar would like.
Because
I knew that he liked things in that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we probably ended up sounding more like him than we should have done.
It's wicked as well, because just remembering now, Zia as well was another one that was in the... And, but again, even then, it completely... what you were saying, and I guess that's it. You probably all had your own voice and own sound, but I could tell that it was all stuff that Polar would like.
Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean? It's all like you're doing your own thing, but all wanting to impress the teacher as
exactly.
such. Whereas as now it's all developed to, right, now I want to impress on myself, essentially, and do what's natural to me. And I think Fat Girls Don't Dance must feel like the kind of epitome of that now, because it's as you said, it's bringing a lot of influences from throughout your whole life in there. I felt sympathetic about 3-4 days in, and you were saying how physical a show it is and how you didn't know if you were going to last
my
the
god
full run,
I was like, I made this show, why did I put so many sit-ups in it? Like there's a section where I run in diagonals from one end of the stage to the other. And I do that for about 4 minutes. It's to a track. And then there's an exercise routine and I do a load of Pilates and sit-ups. And I was thinking, I could have just spoke.
Yeah.
But obviously that's not the point. And I'm glad I did the show that I did. But bloody hell,
in
Edinburgh,
it
was so hardcore. Especially as well, because, you know, you have a bit of a party when you're up there. You have to have a little espresso martini every now and then.
You've planned a good show then, really, because you're forcing yourself to work out every day, to keep healthy body, healthy mind.
Yeah, it's not the easiest one to do on a hang, though.
I can imagine. So what's the plan going forward? Is this show going to tour? Because it always scares me with Edinburgh that it's this beautiful month where these amazing shows develop to be their absolute peak, and then so many of them never appear anywhere again because next year it's a new show and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So what's the plan? Is there going to be more performances and touring of Fat Girls Don't Dance, or is there a new project?
I'm bringing it home, so I'm taking it back to the Roundhouse in October.
Fantastic.
25th and 26th of October. So just 2 nights at the Roundhouse in the studio there. Then I'm going to have a bit of a break, but I do plan to put a tour together for next year. I also want to do more educational work with it and visit more schools and young people and do a bit more around that sort of side of it as well. New project, don't know. People. So I got back from Edinburgh and they're like, oh, well, what are you doing next year then?
It's like, geez.
I was like, you know.
Can we just revel in the fact that I had a lot of sold-out shows this year? I've survived. no one died, you know, and all this kind of thing. It's like,
I didn't die.
You have to be straight on to, so what's next year?
What's coming up next for it? I don't think I can put together a piece of work that I'm happy with in
that amount of time.
Yeah. I just don't think.
Again, I think more people should quite happily be every other year and things,
yeah,
things,
I think
things
that's
like
sensible.
That with Edinburgh, because I think it gives you that time. And I said, from here in the time you've spent developing this show, why would you want to do the next show rushed or in a fraction of the time? You know, you've built a good name and a successful show there. If you go back next year and your show's kind of a rushed and it's only got 5 sit-ups and 2 sprints, you know,
it's just not good enough, is it? It's just not good enough. I'm going to have to run a marathon for the next one. I don't know. It's the idea as well, isn't it? Because you have to have an idea that you're behind and that is very specific to you.
And equally, I completely applaud continuing an idea. And from the sound of the topic and taking it into schools sounds like a fantastic thing. I love... All you guys at the Roundhouse Collective, I think, again, are perfect people to be going into schools, because it's something I always struggle with, because no one ever taught me spoken word or any of that. So I've never known what is a good way to inspire someone and so on and so forth. But because you've all come through a teaching element of it with that Roundhouse Collective, you're kind of equipped to go into schools and know, at least in a way, how to engage and how to connect with kids and get them excited about it.
I think it is an important thing to do. I don't think it's for everyone, and I don't think every spoken word artist should do it at 100%, 100%. All. But I think, you know, if you're interested in that, then it is a valuable thing to do. The good thing as well with the spoken word community is everyone's so close.
Yeah.
So you can really learn off each other. I know, you know, I share exercises and facilitation ideas with other artists, same as you do writing exercises and getting together and writing. I mean, I've basically got a new family out of doing Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Have those new links and stuff like that. I was living with a couple of guys that do Boomerang Club, which is a spoken word night in London, with Gecko, who's a sort of like spoken word / musician, who's amazing. Yeah. Harry and Chris.
Yeah.
Harry Baker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He did a show with a jazz musician this year, Chris Reed, the Harry and Chris show. It was blinding. And
I've heard that's amazing. I've seen the poster for it again. But
it's beautiful because you go and you... support each other, but then you get so much out of that.
Yeah.
You know, you can build up you know, your own toolkit, if you like. And
It's amazing. When I had Marcus Brigstock on, weirdly that episode he talks about having an eating disorder and his struggles with it, and it's a great episode that I'd recommend you listen if you get a chance, because it feels it relates to some of your show. But on that as well, we were talking about how at points, the really good shows at Edinburgh, you have to go and catch a couple of times, because when it's someone like Harry and things like that, I guarantee that 10 minutes in, something will give you an idea for something that you could do, and it's not ripping anything off, but you'll just, that'll be on your mind, and you'll be like, oh, I could go off in this direction and do this and do that, and that's kind of the beauty of those friendships and inspirations you get up there. Mm. Well, we're going to end on... a poem, if that's okay. But before we do, where can people keep up to date on everything that you're doing and what's ahead?
So you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @Kerdonk.
@Kerdonk.
Yeah, KERDONK. But if you put Maria Ferguson in, it comes up. And I've got a blog as well. Who hasn't?
Excellent.
It's just a Tumblr. So if you put Maria Ferguson Tumblr in, it comes up. It's Panda in Disguise.
Excellent.
Because I love pandas. And it was discovered yesterday that pandas are no longer an endangered species.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I think
that's fantastic news. Yeah.
So I'm going to do a poem with...
A shout out to the pandas.
Yeah, shout out to the pandas. I'm going to do a poem with the word panda in it.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Let's do it. There are too many babies on my newsfeed. I am posting pictures of cake, poetry, pandas. How am I even a grown-up? I've never been in love, at least not with someone who loves me at the same time, simultaneously. And all these girls I went to school with are having babies, some of them 2, at least one of them 3. I drink a whole bottle of wine on a Tuesday and call myself an artist. I can't tell whether I hate myself or just everyone else. There are very few exceptions. You are one of them. you assure me we are young, that really you are only a boy. But I know your mind has been ticking, your spare time clogged with these images of rings and girls you once knew in white dresses, babies that all look the same, because they're babies. I mean, what happened to the hangovers? The streams of sweat-soaked faces heaving clubs. What happened to us? Mush. I swear I must have been dreaming when I saw a picture of a narrow front door, a set of keys, another woman's face. I still remember that day you turned to me, cocked your head to the side, to this little boy, all sandy hair and hazel eyes, and you said, he looks like he could be ours. And I was like, shut up. But you told me that you'd play football with him on a Saturday. We'd play in the garden. I'd make the tea. Mate, I know we were only pretending. But I don't know what I'll do when it's yours. Staring up at me through a screen instead of from my arms.
Joined now by Raymond Anthropus. How you doing, man?
I'm good, Scoobius. How you doing?
I'm good. I've been aware of you for ages, or a decent while. I've had you on stage at Best of One, maybe at Camp Best of One, I think, in the past as well. What was your kind of introduction into poetry and into spoken word? Where did you start? What inspired you to start doing it, and what were your moves in that way?
I mean, I'd always written. I guess I was writing stories, and then I was writing raps, and I wasn't aware of spoken word until I went to the States in 2007 and saw a poetry slam.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, that was the perfect example of what I needed to see of what can be done beyond, you know, just writing on your own in the room.
Yeah.
So I came back to England, and funnily enough, I met up with a friend who said, oh, have you heard of Scoobius Pip?
Nice.
I was like, no. He's like, well, you know, he apparently does this poetry thing on stage with music. Let's go check him out. And that was in a venue that's now closed down called The Spitz.
Yeah.
And it was you, it was Tim Wells, and it was Chris Redmond.
Yeah.
And so we came down, and I remember that night, like, genuinely changed my life.
Amazing.
It showed me, again, what was possible. I needed to see the example, right, of that. So literally off the back of kind of the inspiration of that, I started doing poetry slams.
Yeah.
And I went to the Farrago Poetry Slam. Mm-hmm. I became runner-up to a poet called Deanna Roger. And along the years, I started kind of, I guess, winning more slams. I then went to Chicago, where I was just introduced to a whole other poetry community.
Yeah.
And then what I've tended to find is, because I've been in so many places, from Kenya, South Africa, Switzerland, Germany, you know, all around the States, I just find the poets and the poetry community, and I find my place, no matter where I am in the world.
It's one of the things I really, has always struck me about you specifically, is that completely engrossing yourself in the scenes. Like, I'd say you're one of the most well-travelled spoken word artists. Now, there's other people in the UK scene who might be higher up than you on a bill or be doing their full show or tour, but I think there's very few who can compete with you for experience of taking in spoken word styles and approaches from all around the world. So what kind of drove that? What kind of motivated you to go, right, hang on, I could just... Because a lot of people, and I think it's the same with live bands, it's easy to get into your local scene and just that consumes you. You become the king of the local scene, and that's when you're setting yourself up for failure because you're big fish in a small pond, essentially, rather than getting that experience. And then you go out of that scene and suddenly you're not getting that same reaction, and it crushes you and breaks you. So what was it that drove you to kind of go and take in so much variation?
I think first and foremost, like, I'm a poet, I'm a writer, and I'm a reader before anything else.
Yeah.
And I feel like I went through a long time of looking for that. I was looking for to be seen as a poet for what I do. But it just wasn't going to happen because I wasn't chasing a record deal.
Yeah,
I didn't want to be a musician. Yeah. You know, I wasn't looking to kind of, I suppose, occupy that kind of space. Yeah. So I needed to kind of find, and I'm still dealing with this now, find ways to kind of turn off the noise of kind of what's the benchmark in popular culture of success, you know? And there's a great quote from Einstein, which I live by, which is, don't strive to be a person of success, strive to be a person of value.
Yeah.
And so I've taken poetry into schools. I've been working in different schools within my local community for the past 4 years. And I've found that has given me, as I say, as Einstein says, like more value, I suppose, than standing on stage and just having people applaud me for the sake of applauding.
Yeah, I get that completely. I remember Kate Tempest and Polar Bear we'd regularly meet up just to have a drink, moan about stuff, moan a lot about the spoken word scene.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we realised was there was an era when you get to a certain level in spoken word and then you add a live band.
Yeah.
And then there became the era of you get to a certain level in spoken word and then you do an hour-long show.
Mm.
And it's weird that these things become so formulaic and it becomes, well, here's what you need to do to be a success.
Mm, yeah.
And it's a strange one because both of those are completely valid routes, but they shouldn't have a disparaging effect on those who don't choose to take that route.
Exactly.
They're not the only route. I'm fine with that being a part of the scene and of the system, but not when it's at the detriment of, oh, you've not got a one-man show or a band. You're probably not that valuable. Then.
I mean, it's important to know what motivates you ultimately, and I think that I've found, having taken the time out now, I've realised that in some ways, being so hyper visible, and you know, we were talking about Twitter and social media, being on stages where like you've got one chance with a poem to impress an audience and have a kind of instant response from that. Like if that guides you, you just end up in a circle.
Completely.
And I found that going for years.
I think that's completely valid. And I've never done that many slams really. And it's kind of because of that, because of the nature it can cause. I think as humans in general, it's important to experience many different emotions,
yes,
and variations of emotion. It shouldn't, I talk about this a lot on the podcast, I think we put too much value at times in happiness. I think happiness is awesome.
Mm.
I really rate it. It's like one of the top things, but it's not the only thing. And I think there's a lot of different emotions. And I think that translates into spoken word is the slam scene or the short poetry gig in front or anything that seems competitive. You then get in the habit of chasing a specific reaction.
Yeah.
And a poetry gig could be the best gig ever and not get a single bit of applause.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? It could just be that silence and reverence and people are taking it in. There's many. And again, from a poem, you could be wanting to leave people silent or wanting them to be laughing or vice versa. There should be this variation. Whereas, as you said, that becomes a competitive scene. Then if you've got one piece. And Farago's a great example with their slams. I've seen poets there that have amazed me in that context, and then I've been surprised to see their actual full gig is nothing like that. Because you get in that habit of, I need that thing that's going to make everyone pop and everyone laugh. When that's not necessarily the be-all and end-all as a poet.
It's not. It's limited. I mean, the way that I see it now is when I was doing slam, I was living in an Olympic swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
I want to live in an ocean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that's so awesome. It's like I need space. I can't have noise in me while I'm writing while I'm trying to work something out, and it can't be reliant on, like you say, again, that kind of, wow, that was amazing. You know, as you know, I'm writing my first full poetry collection at the moment, and it's funny because I've written a lot over the years, and I gave it to an editor, and he looked at a lot of the stuff, and he said, this is, you need to figure out more stuff on the page. I see why this works when you perform it live. I see why you get a response, but let's talk more about form, and let's talk about how these moves can be condensed.
Yeah. It's amazing. I've had similar, I've been writing a novel for ages, and there's certain little bits in it that have poetry.
Yeah.
And my brother is incredibly well read, and he started to go through it, and he was like, right, how do you want me to give you feedback on this? The poetry in this, is this the character in the book saying it out loud, or is this page poetry? Because if it's page poetry, it's not very good at the moment. You know, it was kind of, and again, I had a similar thing where it's like, I'm an established poet. How dare you? What do you mean it's not very good? He's like, it's not got the strength. Again, I can completely see that you performing this on stage, that's going to pop. That's going to sound great. Yeah. But on this writing, so again, in this context, he was like, but that could be okay
if
this isn't the character written poetry.
But then it's a weird mix. Let me ask you then, who do you think you're writing for? You know what I mean?
And yeah.
I think one of the things that really got me about you is when I learned about your speech impediment.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like, I'm partially deaf. I lit read.
I was going to say, it's interesting you say that, because I'd seen you a lot, and then I saw you post a piece about you about your hearing, and I wasn't aware of that at all, and it was instantly intriguing. And that's one of the beautiful things of spoken word is getting to know people. Mm. Like, I've known a Moose Rock Wonga for years, and certain pieces I've seen him perform have told me so much more about him than I would have ever learned sitting in a pub talking. So it's a similar thing there.
I mean, like, I guess that something that everything I write, I feel like I'm thinking about communication and how, I suppose, if I'm honest, like, growing up, I think I felt inferior to, you know, in terms of being able to communicate.
Yeah, sure.
Because I reckon it wasn't picked up straight away that I was deaf. I only started wearing hearing aids from when I was about 10.
Wow.
I needed them all along. So I was slow to start talking. My parents didn't know why I wasn't talking. I was slow to start walking. And I think throughout my life, I think this is what has drawn me to spoken word, because it's completely about being heard. It's completely about being understood on your own terms. And as a lit reader, you need to kind of find that space. Like, I find that I can't have conversations with just anyone.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's a two-way thing. So the same way applying that to poetry. And that's why I'm in this kind of space where I'm trying to learn about communication on a page, because it's like, okay, now it's a different kind of listening, a different kind of interaction happening.
Yeah,
you know, like, did you feel like, did you have a need to communicate with people, you know, and how
you found
that difficult?
It's a fascinating one, the similarities there, because again, for me, I don't think it was a conscious thing. I think I started writing because I fancied it, and I'd seen people like Saul Williams and Sage Francis these guys. I thought, man, I want to do that. But there is something there that both of us will have grown up with. And I talk about this every now and then on, it's a weird one with a speech impediment, and it's going to be incredibly similar with your hearing and whatnot. Is one of the things that we talk about the most as a basic human right is freedom of speech.
Yes.
And neither of us have always had that.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things that you haven't been able to take in properly or easily at the very least. And certain things you probably haven't been able to express easily, particularly in the early years of understanding your situation. And similarly with me, it's that thing where for a long time growing up, there were certain words and certain phrases I knew I couldn't say.
Yeah.
So I knew weren't an option for me.
Yeah.
That's a restriction on your freedom of speech in some ways. It's not the same as a state mandated restriction on freedom of speech or any of these things, but it's still there. So I think it can be conscious or subconscious, a real driver behind that want to have that hunger for using language, for speaking, for writing, for communicating in that way because of years of it being kind of held back. As soon as you've had the training wheels taken off, essentially, it's going, man, as you said, you've spent all this time thinking that the Olympic swimming pool was all there was, and then suddenly you're in an ocean and you're like, look at all of this.
Right.
Let's go over there. Let's go over there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's where I'm at, man. And that's what I'm trying to nurture. And I don't think I could nurture it in the kind of, in the settings of, like you say, of the Olympic swimming pool. You
know? Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I say the word nurture there. One of the other things that struck me early on about you is your passion to work in the community in schools. We've touched upon it briefly. I know you're a poet in residence at the moment. So what was your journey into working in schools and the drive there, and where are you now with all that?
I mean, to be honest, I fell into education. It was an accident. What happened was, when I was in Chicago, I met a poet and a teacher called Peter Kahn. And he had seen me perform and he said, I want you to come into my school and meet my kids, meet my students. And I went into the school and, man, there was 80 students there. It was after school. All of these students were between the ages of 14, 15. Yeah. Every one of them writing poems.
Amazing.
You know, and it was the first time I'd seen anything like that, because poetry to me at that point had always been this solitary thing that I'd done on my own.
Yeah.
And so...
And almost a dirty secret, like...
Yeah, you know what I mean?
At points as well. It's not like... It's not something you'd expect here, 80 or so kids to be staying school to
not
get involved in. So
not
you wouldn't
all.
Imagine that.
So, like, I walked into the classroom and then Peter Kahn introduces me as a poet from London. He's a national slam champion. And that just excited them. And then before I know it, I had a whole line of students just holding their poems, like, one by one, just reading them to me, wanting my feedback, you know.
That's amazing.
And then Peter Kahn just... stood back and he's watching that. And then afterwards he said to me, look, I've got an idea for something I want to do with you. You know, to just remember this interaction. Two years later, he comes to London and he says, right, I've been speaking with Goldsmith University. I want to set up the world's first spoken word education program. It's an MA program.
Wow.
Would you like to pilot it? Now, I left school with I had two GCSEs. I had no qualifications. I hadn't gone to college. And so I let that all be known. And he said, okay, well, we'll see what we can do. I'll fight for you. About 2 months in, I passed all of these interviews. And then there's one more interview. And they say to me, right, go away, come back. We're going to ask you one question. Right. And you're going to have to answer this question to the professors at Goldsmith University and these head teachers at these secondary schools that you may work in, and the head of Apples and Snakes. And so, cool. All right. Went away, came back. And the one question that they asked me was, how has your reading influenced your thinking?
Wow.
Go. I had to speak for an hour just on that.
Oh, wow.
Uninterrupted. I've been reading since I was a kid. Like that's been my thing, you know. Suddenly I'm just spewing all this stuff about my experiences of literature, and not just as a kid but as an adult, and not just of poetry but of fiction and non-fiction and life writing, of biblical texts, of theories and philosophy. Just spewed it all out.
Yeah.
And the next day, you know, like, congratulations, you've got in. Got you onto the MA program, you know.
Was it a massive relief when that turned out to be the question? It's like you're on a game show and suddenly the option comes up of your exact expert subject in the final round. Like, oh,
got this.
Come
got
on,
this.
this is all me.
It was intimidating as well, because I'd always been suspicious of kind of, you know, academic institutions. I've always been this kind of more audio didactic kind of guy. Like, I'm just. Read books. I'm sitting around. I'm just reading. And at that point, to be honest, reading just for the sake of reading. But I don't know. And then I went through it. And then it was really helpful. And I think it did validate certain insecurities I had about being able to speak and who I'm able to speak to.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting, and particularly right now, as we're just coming off the lowest GCSE scores in 10 years or something like that. It's interesting. It's doubly interesting here because you've got the experience of not doing that great at school.
Yeah.
But then you've also got the experience of you're going into education. So you're obviously putting a lot of worth in that as well. And I think that's what a lot of people don't get across, that it's not a, that there's not one answer to it. I did some posts and it caused all these different arguments inside them, and no one was right and no one was wrong. I intentionally did two posts, and one was saying how unimportant GCSEs are, and one was over exaggerating how important they were.
Yeah.
And I had tons of people saying, I've got no GCSEs and I run a business now, so they're not important at all.
Hmm.
Had other people saying, I wouldn't have got on to my A-level course without my GCSEs, therefore I wouldn't have got on to do my doctorate, therefore I wouldn't be studying in a lab at this moment. So, but again, I think both sides of the story are rarely told together.
Yes.
They're not completely irrelevant.
Yes.
To me and you, they kind of were. Mm. I don't remember what GCSEs I got. You didn't do great.
Yeah.
You've gone on to do well because you had that drive afterwards.
Mm.
For other people, they have been hugely important. Again, there became a trend a few years back of going, our GCSEs teach us stuff that we'll never need or never use in real life. They should be teaching us about mortgages and taxes and all this kind of thing. And my argument to that is, a lot of lives are all about that.
Yeah.
But the world would be in a horrible place if all anyone's life was about was mortgages and taxes and bills. It's like, we need other options, whether it be those who are using Pythagoras' theorem to solve huge things, or those who aren't learning either, but are artists and creators and inspirers.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a long time to figure out what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I reckon that even if I did do well in my GCSEs, went to college, went to university between the ages of 16 to 20, chances are I would have studied something I wasn't really that passionate about and got a career in something that's completely irrelevant to what I really want to do, right?
Again, it's a very early point to go, right, we now need to plan your next 6 years, which then plan the rest of your life.
And then,
what?
Now,
we need to know what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
And that's putting you in the Olympic swimming pool.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Instead of the ocean.
Yeah.
Straight away, do some laps.
So how exciting has it been to get to, I'd imagine the lack of inspiration that you maybe got at school is a massive inspiration to how you teach and how you work.
Yeah, it is. It is, because
we're being goldsmiths.
I mean, on one hand, like you say, when I first went, my first year was tough because I felt like a hypocrite. I felt like a fraud. I felt like, wait, this is not an environment where I thrived in.
Yeah.
I can't now become the ambassador for this kind of space.
Yeah.
But it took me about a year to actually rectify that in a way that was like, no, hold on. If there was a poet that came into my school 3 to 4 times a week and gave me some time out to write some poems and to discuss, I don't know, like how we can make a poem out of Othello's speech here, you know, like I would have loved that. I would have had, it would have completely changed my experience and my feelings of school, right? So it's all about how I enter that space and become an agent. I don't want to say agent of change, but in some ways that's true, but an agent of the kind of world I want to see.
Yeah, and it's beautiful as well, because part of the art there is going to be a level of trickery, in my opinion. Is the fact is, some kids will go, right, I've got a choice today between continuing on maths or going and doing poetry for an hour. Right, I'll pick that. That sounds like a right love. So you're kind of tricking them in as this is an excuse to not be doing work, and then hopefully showing them stuff that makes them fall in love with it and engage in it
absolutely.
And see where they can excel. So
I've had quite countless, and I know a lot of poets who've spent time in education, there are other spoken word educators as well, and we've all seen it. We've all had those students who some of them are borderline illiterate.
Yeah.
And but then they have a spark for something. Again, it comes from this thing of having something to say, because they feel something. You know, when you're young, it's an emotional time.
Yeah.
How can you not have something to say?
Yeah.
And once you kind of, they were able to write that, there was a sense of them feeling like this is a place where they belong, because they found a language that can fit and be applauded for. You know, so, I mean, that's, on one level, I guess, we were talking about spoken word being this place where, you know, as an artist, the applause can be damaging.
Yeah.
But in that context, the the applause was important. It was rewarding.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's like anything in or anything that you become passionate about. What initially drives that passion isn't what necessarily has to sustain it.
Mm.
So the fact is, in anything, getting praise and applause is the best way to motivate you to do something more. We're base humans. It's a very simple thing. Whether that be with poetry or with women or with anything else, with sports, anything. It's like that initial motivation is other people are giving me praise for this. Yeah. This is awesome.
Yeah.
What then your job is as a teacher is to then work from that and drive them towards everything that's ahead. Yeah,
exactly. And I guess like 10 years now, like I've been doing poetry and performing, and I'm just at that spot where, you know, we're talking off mic about what are the next steps for poetry, for spoken word artists, you know. I don't know, but I'm trying to let that mystery excite me.
Yeah,
in a way, like, you know, I did actually write a show for the Roundhouse. It was called A Language We Both Know. The whole show was with a friend who's a coder, which means child of deaf adult. So her first language was BSL, British Sign Language.
Right.
So I had the whole, worked with two translators, had the whole show translated through British Sign Language. Learned some sign language myself, and I mean, just wow. I mean, the show should have actually been about the making of the show,
and
all the conversations that happened behind the scenes of how, okay, you know, you've got this poem and you've got this image. Well, in sign language, it translates to this image. I need another image to transition into.
I love this. The beauty of, and people don't often understand how different a language, sign language, is, and how it's not a direct translation. No. My mum did a BSL for many years I was growing up, and it's amazing that it's a lot of it is more direct, a lot of it is very abbreviated, a lot of the structures of sentence are moved around. It's why, again, people felt for years that deaf children were simple or weren't as clever, because they often didn't have as good reading, because the sentence structures are different, and it's so streamlined, it removes so much of the pointless words in each sentence. And obviously, as a poet, no words are pointless. These are all wonderful tools, but it's beautiful in its streamlining in ways that it's like, right, here's the direct things. How can I get this across in the most succinct manner?
Right.
So that must have been an amazing experience to turn poetry, which is often about saying something that could be said quite short, in a far more extended and beautiful and frivolous manner. So that must have been an amazing experience to go back and forth on that.
It was, I mean, it was a lot of work. That was the other thing.
I mean, it's interesting, just I'm rambling on now, but it's interesting that you were saying similar about page poetry, how initially you'd write it all down and then someone would say, look, we need to streamline this a lot, because this is written as a spoken word piece. It must have been kind of a similar experience with a translating into BSL, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it was, finding that language in which you can be understood. But one of the reasons I got into spoken word was that it was something I could do on my own, right?
Yeah.
I only had to, in a way, be a master of my own language.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I only needed to be heard in my own terms, which was something that was very personal and private, and then presented to the public. But anything, you know, the page and the stage and working with BSL interpreters, it became a collaboration.
Yeah.
And it became something which became more about communicating, well, with the collaborator, in that you're trying to be... Oh, it was just so frustrating. I'm just thinking now about all the times I was like, no, this is what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to do. Yeah, but it doesn't translate. It's got to, either we leave it, or you go
and amazing.
Spend more time working on the writing, you know? So
I love that. But that's an amazing experience as a writer to have those kind of restrictions.
Yeah.
Apparently, to have someone essentially say, what you're saying, I can't translate that. I can't strip that down. Yeah. You either need to work on it to make it clearer and less. And again, it's another thing that I found with having my written stuff analysed a bit, was there's far more, and Kate Tempest has said this as well, there's far more that you'll use a phrase or a reference in spoken word and it will seem to work, but under deeper analysis, it's pointless.
Yeah.
It has no place there.
Other than
it sounds good and you can deliver it hard
and
twist on that exact point and, you know, have that inflection. And that's, yeah.
But one of the things that I really, I think her name is Kathleen Rain, and she talks about how when you write down a word, you write down language, that is a seed.
Yeah.
You're planting something. And there's a lineage to that language because it comes from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Of other dead languages,
Latin,
kind of stuff. But when you speak a word, it's what's more important is the energy, is what is felt as it's spoken and how it's received. It's this immediate thing.
Yeah.
So in a way, they're two different mediums, you know?
Yeah, of course. So it makes sense.
Like trying to exist in those two spaces as someone who came to poetry, I mean, through music and through the love of the sound of words and performing, it can be, it's jarring, you know, because I'm trying to find, in a way, I'm trying to speak two different languages to portray the same idea.
So energy and...
Yeah, energy.
That's fascinating. Well, I'm ending each of these sections on a spoken word piece. So before we do that, though, can you let people know, I was going to ask what's ahead, but we've made it quite clear that we've no idea what's ahead. So where can people keep up to date on what's ahead on social media and stuff like that?
At Raymond Antrobos on Twitter. I'm currently just to kind of pass the time and feel like I'm putting something out. I have a YouTube channel called Ray Recommends where I just interview different poets and writers. The last one I interviewed my local bookshop seller.
Amazing.
Just to see, like, you know, why is it poetry selling? And or is it selling? Because I see you've got a big section of poetry at the front of your bookshop, you know. So we have discussions like that.
That's wicked.
So yeah, I think and I've just got a website, www.raymondantrobos.com.
Perfect. Cool. Well, thank you very much. And what would you like to end on?
Oh man, this is tough. I think because again, talking about the two different languages of like the page and the stage. Should I do a page or should I do a stage?
It's up to you.
Okay, so, all right, I'll do this one. As you said about, like, traveling, what I've found is, I mean, in the last year, I've been to Kenya, I was in the States, I was in Jamaica. I kept getting stopped by the police.
Oh, wow.
Or border, like, no matter what or where. And I had this particular...
I mean, we've not touched on your ethnicity at all, which I'm kind of pleased with. I'm glad that hasn't come up, because it can be a default kind of...
Well, I mean, my dad's Jamaican, my mom's English.
Yeah.
So I'm mixed race, but I suppose I'm not the classic mixed race look. I'm quite ambiguous looking, right? So when I'm in the States, people often think I'm like Mexican.
I mean, you're gold as an actor.
Yeah.
Because you could be cast in almost any.
Yeah.
And I've found it since I've started going into acting is because I tan and I've got a slender nose, but a dark skin and all this. They're like, we can cast you in most European countries, a lot of Middle Eastern countries. It's like, it's handy. That's your story there.
I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it's so this one particular incident that happened in Miami, where I'm just randomly pulled over by the police, and it was such a disorientating image. And I guess because we were talking as well about the how poetry can find value and be useful. I'm going to read this because this is the last thing I wrote, which I found so useful to help me understand what just happened to me.
Right, amazing.
Okay, and it's just called Miami Airport. And it's, okay. Why didn't you answer me back there? You know how loud these things are on my waist? You don't look deaf. Can you prove it? Do you know sign language? ID? Why didn't I see anyone that looked like you when I was in England? Why were you in Africa? Why don't you look like a teacher? Who are those photos of? Is this your girlfriend? Why doesn't she look English? What was the address you stayed at? What is the color of the bag you checked in? What was your address again? Is that where we're going to find dope? Why are you checking your phone? Can I take your fingerprints? Why are your palms sweating? You always look this lost. Why did you tell me your bag was red? How did it change color? What color are your eyes? How much dope will I find in your bag? Why isn't there dope in your bag? Why did you confuse me? Why did you act strange when there was nothing on you? Would you believe what I've seen in the bags of people like you? You think you're going to go free? What did you not hear?
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. Man, that was part one. And it's packed, isn't it? These are packed. I'm excited at the length of these. I'm excited to get to talk to all these people. And I'm excited that all of you are getting to experience what would normally be experienced on a small stage in the middle of the woods on the Isle of Wight. So thank you for tuning in. I hope you're going to tune into part two. That's going to be up at midday. As I mentioned, in fact, I should go back and reference, you've listened to Rob Alton, Maria Ferguson and Raymond Anthrobus. Check them all out. I recommend you do more research on all of them. If you're keen for part two and have to wait, spend that time looking them up on social media, looking them up on YouTube and checking them out. But in part two, we're going to have the legendary Holly McNish, the wonderful Jack Rook and the superb Cecilia Knapp. So check them out. Subscribe, all that kind of thing. Spread the word, in fact. If you can spread the word on this one, it'll be beautiful. It's a spoken word special. That's special to me. All right, I'll see you in a bit. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.